All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Nebraska is now open for the transaction of business. Draw nigh, all ye having business with this honorable court, and ye shall be heard. God save the State of Nebraska and this honorable court.
Thank you. You may be seated. Thank you, Bailiff Gonzalez, and good morning to everyone. We cannot see anyone out there, but I'm trusting you're out there. So we will begin this morning by introductions of members of the court. I am Mike Havikin, and I am the Chief Justice, and now by order of seniority as to service on the court, the other members of the court will introduce themselves.
Good morning. I'm Lindsay Miller-Lerman.
William Castle. Good morning.
Stephanie Stacy. Good morning.
Good morning. I am Jeff Funk.
I'm Jonathan Papik. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm John Freidenberg.
Thank you, members of the court. And we will proceed then with cases for today. And the very first case is Velleba versus Mackiewicz, and I'm going to ask counsel for both parties to come up on the stage, if you can see to come up on the stage. Good morning. Mr. Robb, are you with us this morning? Or excuse me, Mr. Kenny, I'm sorry.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
And good morning to you, and is Mr. Puthy? Very good. And which one of you is arguing? Okay. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin?
No, Your Honor.
Then, Mr. Kenny, you may approach the podium and you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. If your honors would indulge me, I'm thrilled to be here. In 1989, I taught American government to the senior class at Mount Michael High School. And in the ensuing 33 years, I have never approached the nobility or the usefulness of that particular year. And so I'm thrilled to be here. My name is John Kinney. I represent Gary Velleba, the appellant in this action. Your honors, the date of the marriage in this case was 1995. The date of the divorce was 2017. We have a 22-year marriage. The parties agreed that it was an alimony type of case, meaning that the wife, my client, was entitled to an award of alimony. And as your honors are aware, alimony is to compensate a spouse for non-economic contributions to a marriage. In this case, the parties agreed that my client was entitled to 13 years of alimony after the divorce decree was entered, and the modification in 2020 basically eviscerated that alimony award. I think we calculated in our brief that my client, by virtue of the 2020 order of modification, was denied $233,000 of alimony. And so, thank you. And so, Your Honors, this is a significant denial of a property right to my client. A word on the standard of review. In reading the cases and in reading Carlson in particular, ambiguity in a decree presents a question of law, and it's reviewed de novo. Typically, a modification case is going to involve an abuse of discretion. However, to the extent that this court determines that the waiver of breach clause and the alimony clause create an ambiguity in the decree, it provides for a different standard of review because we would be looking at potentially ambiguity. I do also, Your Honors, need to distinguish the Grothen case from 2020. I think that it is important to note that in the Grothen case, the court concluded that, and I'm quoting, our statutory and case law supports the conclusion that where the parties have not expressly precluded, and I emphasize the word or limited modification of alimony, the good cause standard should be used. I think it is abundantly clear in this case that the parties agreed to make alimony non-modifiable. The reason why I believe that, on behalf of my client, Your Honors, is that the language of the decree basically is unequivocal, and it states that the death of the defendant or remarriage of the plaintiff shall not terminate the alimony order.
Is that the same as shall not modify?
No, Your Honor, but I don't find anywhere in our jurisprudence that magic words are required.
I beg your pardon, in Grothen we also wrote, that is, unless the party's agreement specifically provides that alimony may not be modified, modification of alimony is governed by the, quote, good cause provision in 42.365.
Yes, Your Honor.
So what does that do to your argument?
Well, Your Honor, when you stop and pause after you read the phrase, the death of the defendant or remarriage of the plaintiff shall not terminate the alimony order, that is a critical difference factually from all of the other cases that have addressed this good cause issue, Grothen, Desjardins. When you pause there and then you move to, and it shall be in place until such time as it is fully satisfied. Until such time as it is fully satisfied. Now, there are other cases that have looked at that language and said and have determined that that does not mean that the alimony is non-modifiable, but those other cases didn't have the preceding sentence that said that this alimony is going to last through the death of the defendant, meaning my client has a claim against his estate if he dies. And my client...
I think you're bumping up against the tension between modifying and terminating alimony. Or do I misunderstand what you're saying?
I don't know. I don't know that the statute, if you look at 42.365, Your Honor, I believe that the statute says that an alimony order shall terminate upon the death of either party or the remarriage of the recipient. Is that what you're... pointing out is that the statute says terminate?
Yeah, in cases. Cases of termination may be different than cases of modification.
The statutory rubric would suggest that the common law has to manage the modification of alimony, and the statute deals with the termination of alimony. But in this case, we're basically dealing with the evisceration of alimony. But
is there also language in the agreement itself that suggests that modification is a possibility?
Your Honors, I don't think you can go to the boilerplate waiver of breach section, which is completely separate from the alimony section, and read that language and read the argument of counsel for the appellee and not raise an eyebrow. That waiver of breach language is standard boilerplate in a decree. It makes no reference to alimony. And I would hearken us back to contract principles, which basically tell us that when a general provision and specific terms in a contract relate to the same thing, and that's arguable, I'm not sure they even relate to the same thing, the more specific provision controls. And we all understand, I think, that even though a property settlement agreement is a contract, it becomes a judgment, and we don't necessarily always apply contract principles once it becomes a judgment. We still have to look at the two competing provisions here and say to ourselves, wait a minute, when these folks bargained for alimony, they created a specific agreement that dealt with the alimony issue and waiver of breach. I mean, I don't mean to be dismissive of that, but it's a boilerplate paragraph thrown in at the end of a decree.
And what difference does it make if it's boilerplate? It's part of the agreement, is it not?
Understood, but it's vague. It's not contained in the alimony paragraph. It makes no reference to any specific provision in the decree. I understand that parties might be bound by their lawyers placing a boilerplate paragraph into a decree and not think about the impact it might have later. But in this particular case, I don't know how you could look at it's styled as, it's captioned as waiver of breach. I mean, it makes no reference to the party's contract, their agreement on division of assets and debts. It makes no reference to alimony. And I'm really having a hard time with the notion that waiver of breach paragraph means that the parties agreed that alimony would be modifiable.
Do you also contend that this is a total package agreement, equalization payments, alimony, all those factors come into play?
Well, what I implied in my brief and the communication that I was attempting to project was that as a domestic relations lawyer, I am very familiar with the negotiations that go on prior to decree being entered. And many, many times we cut deals where alimony or child support or property equalization is moved around and we...
Right. What do we find in our record about that?
There is nothing in the record that suggests specifically that the alimony award was put in place as a result of my client not receiving as much property. Understood. I have no evidence in the record. I wasn't the trial counsel. There's no evidence in the record suggesting that quid pro quo, that connection.
So where does that leave this court with the concept that you're talking about, that divorces involve trade-offs?
Well, I think under these particular facts, when you look at the alimony paragraph in particular, and it is very unusual for an alimony paragraph to say that alimony survives remarriage.
Isn't that clause actually reflecting the statute we've talked about?
No, it's not reflecting the statute. It is the lawyers negotiating the statute away. In fact, if the alimony paragraph was silent on that issue, our cases say that the statute takes control. So in other words, if lawyers mess up and they don't put in the language that they're supposed to, then the statute rescues them. But what I'm saying is the lawyers involved in the 2017 negotiation said to themselves, we are going to make a specific paragraph that changes the statutory scheme where we tell the world this alimony is going to last through your marriage and it's even going to last through the grave. After the defendant dies, the plaintiff has a claim against his estate. And so when you read that paragraph, and then you read the next paragraph that says that this alimony will continue, I think you have to conclude that these folks bargained for non-modifiable alimony, even though they didn't use magic words.
If we disagree with you that this alimony issue is non-modifiable, where does that leave your argument? Do you have an alternative argument,
well,
or does it hinge upon non-modifiable decree?
No, I think I made it clear in the brief that when you leave an 8-year career in the finance industry and you take a flyer on a job in another state that you yourself call a startup, that you shouldn't be able to come back to court and ask for a modification when that startup doesn't work out for you. And I think I compared that to some other cases, child support cases, other situations. I think it's most applicable to the case where a gentleman wanted to go back to college and he wanted to reduce his child support. We don't have somebody who's, you know, had a drug or alcohol problem here, nothing like that. But the appellee in this case knew he had this 13-year alimony obligation when he voluntarily left a good job that he had for 8 years.
Didn't he leave the job for a job where he at least, it looked like he was going to earn more money?
It was actually
an increase.
It looked like, but I think that when you have a 13-year alimony obligation and the ink's hardly dry on your decree, I don't think you get to say this looks like a better opportunity when you yourself know that you're going to work for a startup.
Suppose we throw in with you on this rule, and instead of the new job turning out to be one that doesn't work out, it turns out to be the next Microsoft or the next Meta or the next whatever, and becomes incredibly successful. Does that mean that someone in your client's position would be stuck with no opportunity for amendment in that situation?
Well, Your Honor, as a practitioner in the area of domestic relations for 28 years, I have to tell you, I've never seen a modification effort where a payee has made an effort to increase the alimony. I've never seen it happen. And I know that might not be what you're asking about, but...
I'm asking about the payee.
To your point, when you take the risk, you suffer the consequences when it doesn't work out. When you know you have a 13-year obligation and you know you have a solid job and you volunteer to leave that job, I believe that is how this court should approach that issue.
I want to go back to our standard of review. If we agree with you and your interpretation of whether or not the agreement was modifiable, what is our standard of review?
Well, modification cases generally, the standard of review is an abuse of discretion. But if you are looking at the waiver of breach paragraph and comparing it to the alimony paragraph and determine that there's an ambiguity in the decree, then I think a different standard of review applies. And I think that you have to look at that presenting a question of law reviewable de novo. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. Mr. Fathi, good morning to you.
Good morning to the court.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Rob Futhi, Fraser Stryker Law Firm, on behalf of the appellee, James Makowitz. As mentioned, I have Mr. Arkfeld, who worked on the brief with me here as well. Your Honor, I want to start with the key issue in this case, which the trial court had to wrestle with three times, was whether or not the terms of this decree was modifiable. And Judge Bowie ruled on it on a motion to dismiss, a motion for summary judgment at the trial, and here we are again for the fourth time on this. Now, in Ms. Velba's brief, there's citations to cases in Wisconsin, citations to cases in Georgia, Florida, all over the place. But the one thing they don't wrestle with is the Grothen case. And that is the key case here, Judge Miller-Lerman, that you wrote back in 2019. We cited it at the trial court level, and the argument that we got up until the trial completely was, this is not a modifiable divorce decree. So I want to start out with looking at what the decree says itself. The language that Ms. Velba relies upon says in paragraph 8A, the death of James or the remarriage of Carrie shall not terminate the alimony order and shall remain in place until such time as it is fully satisfied. Now, as I understand the argument, they're hanging their hat on until it's fully satisfied. Now, what Grothen says is you must be expressly stating you do not want to modify the divorce decree. So that's why we pulled in our brief another district court order from more recently. It's a story case which has some express language that was put in the decree that says under 42.366 sub 7, the parties hereby expressly agree that alimony shall not be modified, and you know we've considered this and we think it's for the best interest of getting this thing resolved. All that stuff. That's express language that says it shouldn't be modified. That's not what we have here.
So is that part of the bargain of the agreement?
It was part of the property settlement agreement that was incorporated into the final decree. There was no evidence presented at the trial as to, you know, what was part of the agreement between the parties back then. I mean, the evidence at trial was that James did not want to sign the decree. His lawyer actually withdrew at the time from him signing it, and he went ahead and did it at Carrie's request or behest. Ultimately, Judge Bowie didn't want us to get into that and just kind of focused on the modification issues. But that language that actually was put in the decree, which was the decree that was drafted by Kerry's lawyers at the time, ultimately does not have the express language limiting it from being modified.
Both the survival of the alimony award provision still exists, right?
It certainly does. So the default under 42.365 is alimony goes until one of the people dies or the recipient remarries. But it says you can contract out of that. And that's what was done here.
So those both exist even after the modification?
Absolutely, yes.
And still whatever the amount that is going to be incurred for alimony still has to be satisfied. It can't be discharged, just like the agreement says, correct?
That's what the decree says. But so the language in the decree contracts out of the default in 42.365 saying, you know, won't terminate upon death or remarriage. But that language doesn't mean it's not modifiable for any other purpose forever. And so that's why we look at what's in paragraph 8T with regard to the language with regard to modifications, where it says the decree may be modified upon the agreement of the parties in writing subscribed or unless otherwise ordered by the court.
So echoing Justice Castle's questions, is this ruling forever, or could there be another modification proceeding if the ex-husband hits the jackpot?
Don't think James is hitting the jackpot, but if something else happens, if there's another substantial and material change in circumstances, it's still subject to the modification provisions in 42.365.
So the court's order of modification reduced the amount of alimony, correct?
Correct.
And it also reduced the term of alimony, didn't it?
It did.
What rationale did the trial court judge give for reducing the term of alimony? And it was a pretty drastic reduction in the term, wasn't it?
It was, and James had a pretty drastic change in the circumstances. Well, he went from making about $200,000 to $250,000 down to $30,000
in 2020. So what was the rationale that the court gave for drastically reducing the term of the alimony award?
So the purpose of alimony is to make sure, I'm going to disagree with what Mr. Kinney said, under the Anderson case, the purpose of alimony is to ensure for a period of time necessary that the individual secure in his or her means of support. Now, the other part of it is whenever you are doing a modification, you look at the circumstances of the parties at the time of the divorce, and then you also look at them at the time of the modification request as well. And so here, you had James going from basically making $200,000 down to under $30,000, but you also had Kerry going from making $30,000 plus $60,000 from the alimony she was getting from James at the time of the decree originally being entered, to her making about $90,000 to $100,000 at her job, plus the $8,400 that James will be paying.
That part of the formula, her increase in salary could have been anticipated at the time of the divorce and was anticipated, was it not?
What I'll say with that, Your Honor, is if James had kept his $200,000 job, nothing happens on his side of the ledger, and he comes into the court and asks, well, Kerry's making more money, I think we lose that case absolutely. But under the cases make clear, I think it's in Grothen's actually stated this, you have to look at the total circumstances that are presented as well. So I don't think Kerry getting an increase in the amount of money that she's making in and of itself, by itself, is sufficient to have a modification. But it is part of the mix for reviewing the totality of the circumstances to make sure that the purpose of alimony, which is to ensure support, is met.
If we agree with you that the agreement is modifiable, what is our standard of review as to how the judge modified?
If once you get over the modification question, then it goes to, I believe the standard is de novo on the record for abuse of discretion. I take that to be essentially abuse of discretion. We went through in the brief the circumstances for James's change, and I'll actually go into a couple of that now as a segue. James went from making $200,000 down to $30,000. Actually, I believe it's on page 10 of the transcript, or the Bill of Exceptions. There's testimony about the new business James went to work for down in Texas was a division of a larger company. This wasn't just some startup off the street. He went down there because he thought he was going to make more money. He was laid off after about 6 months. He was terminated. And so he moved back to Omaha in February of 2020, we all kind of remember, I think, what happened around that time period. That's when COVID happened, obviously. There weren't a lot, frankly, of $200,000 jobs just waiting around to be plucked off the tree at that time. Now, the evidence was, and this is in Exhibit 34, which I examined James about during the trial, all the job-seeking activities that he did and continued to do while this proceeding was pending as well. He contacted the folks that had recruited him. He made contacts with other people in the industry. He went back to AssetMark, which was the company with whom he had worked for before, to see if he could get his job back. He applied for other jobs with similar companies, including one a couple of months before the trial that he didn't get. He started this franchise through Crescom as well.
So did he have to show the judge that there was good cause for modification, or?
So under 42.365, he needed to show that there was good cause, which the court in Growth and in other cases has said is a substantial and material change of circumstances. And even if we're talking about the gross inequity standard that the appellate puts forward, I think we still met that burden as well. But even under the good cause standard, too, we clearly met that standard.
Good cause is easier for you to achieve.
Absolutely.
What do we know about the termination from the job in Texas?
The evidence in the record was that James was notified in around January 15th of 2020 that things weren't working out and he was being let go. He moved back to Omaha thereafter. He applied for unemployment when he got back here. As part of the unemployment application, he needed to let the folks know why he'd been terminated. So he called up the HR department, and they said you were let go for unsatisfactory job performance.
And that's the extent of the evidence?
Anything beyond that, you know, in terms of, you know, there's the case that was cited about sleeping on the job and getting drunk. There's no evidence of that in the record. The court would have to speculate as far as going into why he was actually terminated on that.
If we agree with you that alimony was modifiable here, but we don't like the way the trial court judge modified, can we send it back to have the judge try again, or can we modify it here?
No, I don't think you can modify it here. The other problem with that is Carrie put all of her eggs in the basket of non-modifiable. She didn't put on any evidence at all as to what it should be. So we put on evidence that James could pay $700 a month over the six or seven, whatever it was, years. That was the only evidence before Judge Bowie at the trial court. There was no alternative suggestion made as to what the alimony should be. So the evidence in the record supports what Judge Bowie decided, and I don't think you can reverse him on that. It's within his discretion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
We have no time for rebuttal, so that